everyone. This is JJ Outlaw.
And this is T Outlaw.
And we are back with a very special episode of the Gourmet Goober podcast. You can always find me, JJ Outlaw, at least for now, on Twitter at, well, JJ Outlaw. I'm also on Instagram and Threads at Gourmet Goober. And as always, I'm joined here with my co-host, my BFF, that dude, help dude in charge.
The exceptional Negro.
The exceptional Negro. That's a new one. T yeah. Outlaw, a.k.a. Big Daddy. How's it going?
It is going well. Well, you can find me, T Outlaw, on the X/Twitter at T Outlaw, and also on Instagram at T Outlaw Chelsea Wells.
Awesome. Well, as I said at the start of the show, this is actually a very special episode of the Gourmet Goober. So we're going to be doing a slightly different format than what we normally do. Today's episode, we're featuring a really great interview that I had an opportunity to do with Fasea Oluwadia. And she is a food blogger based out of New York City. And she's also a founder of this really great food tech startup, which is called Rezactly, which actually is a new app that pairs AI with foodies in order to help them discover their primo dining experience. So I'm really excited to have the opportunity to chat with her. And during our interview, we talk about everything from her journey as an immigrant and a Black woman working in tech, as well as we discuss her love of burgers. In fact, she gives a recommendation for the best thing she ate this week that we'll definitely have be on a plane heading out to New York the next time I get. So unfortunately, Big Daddy couldn't make it for the interview, but rest assured, we will both be back with a new episode of the Gourmet Goober podcast next week. So if you miss him this time, no worries. You will hear his velvet Big Daddy voice in the future.
I'm just one of her little Black friends.
So we're going to take a quick break, and then when we return, you'll hear my wonderful interview with Fasea Oluwadia of Rezactly. You're listening to the Gourmet Goober podcast. We will be right back. This episode of the Gourmet Goober podcast is brought to you by Plum Good Media. Plum Good Media is the indie multimedia production company based in Chicagoland, where our mission is to create an inclusive space where we elevate fun, bold, and smart content for all. Check out our shows and learn more about our philanthropic work at plumgood.com. That's plum, G-O-O-D-E.com. Everyone, this is JJ Outlaw, and I am back with the Gourmet Goober podcast. As we had mentioned in the beginning of the show, this is a very special episode as we are welcoming a new person to what we affectionately call here Gooberland. Today, we are welcoming the amazing Fasea Oluwadia. Fasea, besides being an incredible New York-based food blogger, which we will talk about in a moment, she has an incredible history in tech, and she is the founder of Rezactly, which is a new application that all of you should be aware of. And it uses AI to help foodies find unique dining experiences. So in honors of Women's History Month, and just because she's badass, we're really excited to welcome her to our space. And welcome, Fasea.
Thank you so much. I am happy to be here. I can't wait to chat and share all of these experiences and have this conversation with you.
You have an incredible background in food. Can you give us a little bit about that? Your background is Nigerian, is that correct?
Yes, exactly. So I am Nigerian born and raised. I should say Nigerian American, but I'm still a baby American. Only got my citizenship 2 years ago, so I'm very much Nigerian. And because of that, I am also of the Yoruba tribe. Food is, and cooking as a woman is critical. If you're not able to cook, there is a serious problem with you. You have no training. So yeah, I do have home training. So yes, I can cook. But aside from that, food and cooking is something that has been in my family for quite some time. My grandfather was a chef. He cooked for some people in Ghana for a little bit, and then he came back to Nigeria. He had a farm. My mother has a farm right now. It was a chicken farm when I was growing up, and it's expanded to vegetables and now oyster mushrooms. She was also a caterer. So basically, food has been there the entire time. And food has just always been my happy place and my comfort place when anything was going wrong or when things were going right. So
nice.
Same food.
Such a strong foodie background. And particularly with your mom being a farmer and just having the access to good, healthy food and fresh foods and things like that. Was it kind of different coming over to the United States and how so much of our food is processed? And
yeah, definitely. There is a lot of processed foods, even food that are not processed, like eggs. Eggs do not taste like eggs here. If you go to Nigeria, you have eggs. Even Europe, not even just Nigeria, you have eggs. You're cooking eggs. You can smell the eggs. They are eggs. But here, it's like, I don't know what I'm eating. These are not eggs. But I mean, this is what I have access to. So starve or eat.
You know, I have to say, about 2 years ago, my husband, my co-host and I, we had an opportunity to go to London. And I didn't quite understand. I wouldn't have understood rather until my trip over there. I'll never forget the first time I had a British fry up. And, you know, essential part of that is like eggs and sausage. And I just remember diving into that. And I was like, oh, my God, what is this? What am I eating all this time back
home? It's food. It's real food. Not chemically processed, not sprayed with whatever. It's actual food.
I just remember diving in and just looking at my house. I'm sure the other diners probably thought that I had just lost my mind. Like, you've not eaten an egg before. But I'm like, no, I have not. I thought I did.
You have not.
So, yes, I completely get it.
I'm in trouble, you see? But even when I switched over to fully organic, because I was like, okay, this is going to be as close to what I can get at home. It's like, okay, it's better, but there's still chemicals in it.
Yeah, sadly, there is a big difference. And we could just definitely go down a different rabbit hole about, you know, how that affects certain communities and having access to the fresh food and dining experiences and all of that. But yeah, I can imagine that probably was a big change for you. Let me ask a question then. Growing up with such a strong foodie tradition, is that what led to you to start your blog?
Kind of. So basically what happened was my background in tech started in finance, and that's a whole other story. I can tell you about that. So when my time at JP Morgan was over, I'd been there for 6 years, I was looking for the opportunity to be in an organization that gave me more span and more responsibility and more exposure end-to-end ownership of tech. So that was what required me to move over to MLB. So when I moved over to MLB, I went from being a senior engineer to a principal engineer. And at that point in time, being a principal engineer, that was the highest level you can get to. So I'm like, okay, great. I'm a principal engineer and I'm 33. Now what? I kind of have a whole lot of life to live. I need to do something else. And at that point in time, that's when I had first started exploring fine dining. And I loved the whole experience of it, the storytelling, all of that. But I'm going for these dinners by myself, and these dinners are 3 hours long. So it's like, I have to figure out a way to entertain myself while I'm doing this. So I first started with taking photos, and then I'd take notes, and then I'd go home and write because it was like, I just didn't love writing. And then I started posting it and I was getting a following. I was like, this is actually pretty cool. And food writer actually is a job. So give it a shot. And I did. 6 years later, about 50,000 readers a year, 50,000 unique readers a year. So,
wow, that is impressive. So let's take a step back in your journey, if you will, because I think it's fascinating. You started actually in finance before working a little bit more directly in tech. What led to your initial interest in working in finance? You find the integration of, you know, there's an immigrant and you're there as a Black woman. I mean, there's all these intersectional things that affect your walk into that space. What was that like for you?
Sure. When I was in finances, I was also in tech. So basically, let me start from the beginning of where this all started. My father was a stockbroker and he owned a bank. And, you know, you're a child and what you want. Now he dropped all of that and he's a farmer as well. But that's where it started. And, you know, as a child, you're trying to mimic your parents. Like, that's what you see. So I thought I wanted to be a stockbroker. I went to college. My major was economics. And I took one computer science class. And I was like, I'm having so much fun with this. You're a little bit frustrated in the beginning, but the more you do it, the easier it gets. And it's like, you just get a rush when you get something working. I was like, I'm really enjoying this. And I don't get that feeling with economics. So how about I major in computer science? Back then, it wasn't actually clear what you could do with the degree. So I was like, okay, I'll keep economics just in case. I'll keep it as my minor, just in case this doesn't work out. So had the computer science degree, graduated. I was in Indiana for college, moved over to Atlanta for a year, took a year off school, moved over to Atlanta. I was like, let me actually, mostly because there was only one company that offered me a job in Atlanta. So I had to move there. And it was in tech. They said, we'll teach you the skills you actually need to get on the job. And they did. So I worked for a year in the industry as a software engineer. At the end of the year, I was so sad. I didn't want to leave Atlanta. I didn't want to stop working, but immigration, you have to actually stay in school to maintain your status unless a company files your paperwork. And they weren't filing my paperwork. So I had to leave. But my thing, that I learned from that was I absolutely, absolutely loved software engineering, and I'm going to continue this path. And then I went to grad school in software engineering. I was working at the same time, not in using my economics degree, but this was an oil trading platform, the first of its kind. So I was doing some work there. When I graduated, I got a job with Citigroup in New York, and that's when I moved to New York and then never left. But I just kind of figured I am still in some semblance of finance. I'm in tech, I'm an engineer in tech, but I'm also in finance, so I'm also feeding that a little bit. So I was at Citigroup for 2 years, and after that, my time was up, and I said, okay, they filed my paperwork. So I'm like, I want to actually try somewhere else since I can move now. So then I moved over to JPMorgan, where I was there. I was there for 6 years. I worked mostly in the investment bank, but I was doing things from front-end engineering to on a financial platform to creating a UI framework. But at the same time, the thing is, when you are in a large organization, you're very siloed. You do one thing. You're assigned. You do front-end. You do back-end. Somebody does that. And for me, it was very, very fragmented. I was like, I really don't have a full understanding of what it is to create software from the beginning to the end. And it was because I didn't have that, that I said, okay, I need to find something else. One, and two, I'm tired of finance. I finally gave up. I'm like, I need to be in another industry.
I can completely relate, because believe it or not, years ago when I graduated and I got my master's degree in PR, I actually became a stockbroker. I worked for about the first, 7 years of my professional career working at T. Rowe Price and Charles Schwab and Company. So when I hear you talk about the finance and JP Morgan Chase and how seriously it's a very regimented field, it's, oh my gosh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just thinking like,
you did. It's perfectly fine. I'm enjoying that conversation. It's validation. I'm not crazy. It's completely
No, you are not crazy. But I also know, at least from the time that I was in the industry, and I, like you, I got out because even though it's lucrative, for me, I found it a little soul crushing. And it sounds like you had the same thing with the look on your face. The audience is going to be able to see this, obviously. We're just doing the audio. But I tell that story, I'm like, I know that look. I've had that look.
Look, I don't want to get in trouble, so I'm not going to say it was soul crushing.
Made at this moment because I'm like, I've lived that life. Obviously, I didn't go into software engineering. Communication was my passion, but the same thing applies. So yes, you are not crazy. I saw that look and I'm like, I need to just let this sister know that I've been there. I have those shoes, I get it. That's what my grandmother would say.
Oh my gosh. Okay, let's play validation. I was not expecting that as call, so thank you.
You're welcome.
But I got out and I got the opportunity at MLB, and they were like, we're using the latest and greatest tech. You want to be a principal, you're going to do everything. The people, everybody I spoke to was really, really smart. They knew what they were talking about. And I was able to spitfire back and ask questions. I'd ask tough questions. They'd ask me tough questions. And I just loved the environment and how fast it was. The one thing during the interview is I got to the last interview and they were like, so who's your favorite baseball team? I'm like, well, yeah, I don't watch sports. I'm like, is this a requirement for the job? Because I'm joining for tech. I'm not joining for sports. I'm drooling at all your tech and everything you say you're using and all the responsibilities. That's what I'm joining for. If you're telling me I need to know sports, okay, this isn't going to work out. But no, in the end, they're like, it's fine. You don't have to. They made me the offer and I was really excited. That team, the team I worked with was the MLB. They're undoubtedly the best team I've ever worked with in my career. Like, everybody was so smart and so hardworking. It was just a synergy. The guy from product, he asked all of these very detailed, tough questions. And these are questions that I would generally have had to ask. Like, someone will give me a requirement and I have to flesh it out. And I have to ask 20 million questions to get to what I'm actually supposed to be doing. But he already asked all those tough questions. It was like, this is magic. Clear requirements. Absolutely amazing. But what I was doing there, I was on the commerce platform. So you know how when you buy a subscription for MLB, for baseball, you buy it for a season. Now, the thing is, if you don't opt out of auto-renewing for the next season, you'll automatically get a new system and you'd be built. So that process was not the greatest. It really needed to be modernized. So that's what they brought me in for, to modernize the platform from the perspective of how things were stored and also from the perspective of how that process was implemented. So basically, that entire process, it used to take something like a month to 6 weeks to run from beginning to end, creating new subscriptions, billing a subscription, so on and so forth. But it was that way because there was no automation. When I came in, we put in automation. So that process went down significantly. I think it went down to like 2 weeks to get this thing completed. I keep in contact with some of my members, some of the people I worked with then. They were like, we took that, we've optimized it even further. Now it's taken about a day to get it done. So it was like,
wow, that's really impressive.
It felt really good to hear that. I was like, validation. Yes, I'm not crazy.
As you're making these transition, I know for me, one of the things that I found really challenging when I found out your background, I was like, oh yeah, we need to talk about, you know, being a Black woman, navigating all of these spaces. I know years and years ago when I started during the tech bubble, when they had like everyone was investing in a doc, but they didn't know what it did. I mean, they gave it the money. But I was also there when the bubble burst, which was not as fun. And I know that there wasn't a lot of support. I mean, I often found myself in spaces that wasn't really made for me. But then also having to seek out, you know, getting mentors, like getting people that can help guide you through the difficult responses where, you know, you might find yourself on a team and you're the only person of color or you're the only immigrant or things of that nature. Did you find it difficult to find people who kind of help shepherd your career during these early stages along the way? I don't know if I'm saying the question correctly.
Yeah, you're saying the question. As far as being able to find people to mentor and guide, especially in difficult situations. So for me, I never saw a Black female engineer like the coder coming up. And still to this day, I have not seen a Black female engineer.
Really? Wow.
I'm sure they exist somewhere, but I just have not seen them, especially as an immigrant. I mean, I know in Nigeria, there are a lot of people doing investments to get girls coding. So I know it's there. But as far as in my work path in the companies that I worked for, I really didn't come across any. But it's not something that was sad for me, so to speak. I'm someone who's always been lone rider and figuring things out. Throw me in the deep end of the pool, sink or swim. I always swim because it's challenging and it's fun, right? So that's just the person I've always been. And that's basically what happened at every single one of my careers. It's every single one of the companies. I come in, they throw me on the deep end of something that is crashing or it needs to be revamped or rebuilt in 3 months. If not, the company is going to have to renew contracts and pay billions of dollars. So it's like, yeah, I don't know this coding language. There's no documentation for this system. How am I supposed to do this?
Wow. So you're really just kind of thrown into the deep end, as you said, just immediately. Obviously, you've made your own space then.
Yeah, for the most part. That's why it's like, I really don't get scared anymore. The first time it happened, I was like, I don't know what to do here. And there's really nobody to talk to. So it's just kind of like, look, you're an immigrant. If you get fired, you're getting deported. Figure it out.
Okay, I never thought of it that way, but I bet that was probably very,
very, very motivational.
Motivating. Yes, very motivating.
I didn't need mentors. I needed my visa and green card. That same momentum, that same drive that I've always had, I've carried it. I've carried it from company to company, project to project, and it's worked well for me. But I always do try my best to ensure that when I leave a company, I leave a space, I leave enough of a legacy that others who hopefully come behind me will learn from and be able. So it's not going to be, oh, you're just a diversity hire. It's like, no. So the next time you meet a Black female engineer, no. They're not a diversity hire. They actually know what they're doing.
We typically don't get political on the show, but, you know, just talking about the fact that that has been kind of like a touch word lately out there and just having to constantly prove yourself in a given environment that, yes, we're here because we've earned our space and that we're good and we deserve it.
Yeah, I'm going to say something very, very controversial, and I hope you don't get blowback off of this. Like, DEI, I understand DEI, and I understand what it's trying to do. But you're applying DEI at the doorway. You're not applying DEI once they're in the door, right? So I'm spending every meeting, every conversation trying to say, no, they didn't hire me because I was Black. They hired me because I passed this five-hour interview, going across different segments, asking me all of these different questions that I know because I've actually had to do everybody's job and work in all of these roles because, once again, I don't want to get deported. So I definitely understand DEI and I understand the value of it. But at the same time, it's like you're kind of not doing this right.
Yes, it definitely needs to be a more structural change from end to end as opposed to at the beginning. I completely agree with you. And I like the way that you put that, because throughout my life, I've found myself to be, you know, like I had an internship in grad school and I was the first Black woman to ever have that internship. And, you know, I just remember being asked years and years ago, well, why are you here? And, well, I'm here because I had 4 rounds of interviews that lasted me a month. And I'm here because I'm the top of my grad school class. That's how I got here. So, unfortunately, and it shouldn't be controversial, that's the thing. The idea that, you know, you are there because you're hella good should just be a foregone conclusion.
Exactly.
Fortunately, it's not. So I really like the way that you put that, because I think you made it as simple as possible. Like, hey, this is really how it is. Not to mention the fact that, again, like you said, there's a lot of responsibility in being the first or the only one. So it sounds like you're very careful not only to prove yourself while you're in that space, but as you left each company, as you said, making sure that there's a little wiggle room, hopefully, for someone else to take that mantle up after you're gone.
Yeah, it's definitely a tough fight there. Early on, when I first started in career, it's like, I have a temper, I'm not able to control this temper, and then I have this pressure to deliver these crazy deadlines and deliver these projects. So early on, there was a lot of emotional battle and emotional toggle. Because, and then also understanding that the Nigerian work environment, the way coworkers work together, like people are actually real friends, is completely different from the American work environment. It's like, yeah, you got it.
Yes.
So like carrying that and trying to figure that out, layer that on top. Early on in the beginning, it was just a whole lot. So I do kind of feel like when I think back to some of those projects, I still got the work done. The personality could have used it. But past that, I kind of feel like I hit JP Morgan and I hit my stride. And since then, it's been easier to be like, okay, here is someone who knows what she's doing. Here is someone who knows all aspects. Here is someone who's been working crazy 16-hour days. Even though sometimes she really didn't have to, but it was fine. Here is someone who does that, and she's leaving a legacy of Black female engineer going up the ranks and actually still hands-on coding 17 years in the industry, which is something that doesn't really happen. So just leaving that legacy and leaving that story so that others coming behind me, it's like, no, we're going to give them an opportunity.
So walk me from MLB to Rezaqli. Was there's something in that experience that eventually led to you to create what I have to say, it's a really innovative idea.
Thank you. So I was at MLB for, I think, 3 years. And I had a temporary stint at Nordstrom. That switch over was because the interview I had was with a woman, which was the first time I'd ever had a conversation with a woman in tech who actually understood tech. Like, she was a real engineer before she moved to the manager role. So I was like, okay, this will be an interesting experience. So I moved over. And between that and where I am today, I think it was a year, October 2022. That's what it was. OpenAI comes out. Everybody's on the AI bandwagon. I'm like, this is the new gold rush. I want to be a part of this. I need to come up with a product and come up with one now and build it out. And I was banging my head against the wall. What do I do? Okay, do I go back to finance? Well, let me try that. I built a subscription-based system where you can make credit card payments without having to pay your percentage fee, you know, with PayPal and all of those. So I was like, let's get rid of that. So I built that, and I got bored after like a month. I'm like, okay, it's working, but I'm not going to keep doing this. Trash. Then I was doing something kind of like it was a recommendation engine of sorts for medication. You know, when doctors are trying to figure out medication to prescribe generally in the depression and mental illness space, it's really very much a guessing game. So I was trying to build something there that would make that process easier. Once again, built it, got bored, trash. Then I was like, okay, look, I can't keep spending time building these products, get it working, and then it's like, I don't really want to do this anymore. What am I passionate about? What am I obsessed with? Food writing. Okay, we got that set. We've been doing this for years. We've got that set. What do you do when you food write? You recommend restaurants. I am recommending restaurants. So I can build a recommendation engine. What goes into a recommendation engine? I started asking myself all of these questions. And it was like, this is what I look at. This is what I do before I recommend a restaurant. Okay, that's step one, code it. That's step two, code it. That's step three, code it. Get this data, train my models. The point of the fact is, as I was building, I think I went through to 3 months. There was other motivation, which I'll share in a second. But I went through to 3 months, and where I started, I had like, oh, let's just build a recommendation engine. By the time I got to 3 months, I had so many more ideas. And I was thinking to myself, there it is. I have a product that I'm actually going to stick to. It's an intersection of food and tech. I'm absolutely passionate about both of these things. So yeah, that's how we got there.
I think the thing that fascinates me the most about AI is its propensity to learn and adapt to an individual user depending on the needs of the AI machinery. So it sounds like, walk me through this, that's the genius of Rezactly, is it learns each individual user based on their own choices, based on, you know, previous dining experiences, based on their preferences over time, to really craft something that's unique to that individual user.
Yes, exactly. So this is personalization at the extreme level for interaction with food. So when you come onto the platform, you basically say, I like this cuisine. I love these ingredients. I hate these preparations. These are my dietary restrictions. I'm allergic to this. You provide all of that information and Rezactly creates a dining persona for you. And then based off of the restaurants on the platform, it recommends restaurants, giving you the percentage probability that you'll like it. But then it goes a step further in giving you what dishes to order while you're there to have,
wow,
to have the best experience. So you're getting percentage probability, not only at the restaurant level, but also at the dish level. A place where that feature is really important is in group recommendations. So you can create groups, you can add your friends, put like a search location and a search term. Maybe you're saying New York City French restaurants, add all your friends to that group. It will give the percentage probability that the entire group is going to like it and also that you will like it. So for instance, let's say there's a restaurant, it's a 70% probability that you'll like it. And then right next to it, it says 20% probability that the group is going to like it. It's like, wait, what's going on here? You can click on that and it shows you all the members of the group and you can see who it is that's dragging that number down. There's a chat feature that you can then say, hey, we see that you don't particularly like this, but here are the dishes you can order if we're still going to go to this restaurant. So think about how painful that experience generally is for that
one. Oh my gosh, yes. Because there's always that one person.
Right now, it recommends based off of what you put in your personal profile, and you can always update that by going to your profile and updating the story. But what is currently being built is a review model. So with the review model, all you have to do is keep on going to restaurants, keep on eating, and then come and leave your review, what your experience was. And with more information, more reviews, the better your recommendations will become over time.
Are these restaurants, are they currently just New York based, or they draw from restaurants from all over the country?
So right now the restaurants are manually loaded by myself and my data team. So I have restaurants loaded from New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Maryland, Washington, D.C., Florida, California. I'm about to load Chicago, Austin, and New Orleans onto the platform. Nice. Before I jump into that part, I'm just like, let me actually get people en masse to start using these platforms before I start loading and start using the platform before I start loading more restaurants. But those are the next three on the docket that I'm saying I'm going to load. But also I do, in fact, have analytics. If I start seeing more people are coming from different locations, then I might have to prioritize them, right? Because if you're visiting, I want you to ensure that you have restaurants that you can get your recommendations for.
Well, as someone who's in the Chicagoland area, I cannot wait to see the Chicago choices.
Well, then I have to move really fast to get Chicago onto the floor. That's the second person. Second person, second podcast, no less. I'm like, why is Chicago not up? I'll get to it.
If you know anything about Chicago, we love our food. So, yes, I can definitely verify that you will be very popular in my neck of the woods. So where do you see this going? I can imagine there is just so many areas of potential that Rezactly, as it grows as a platform, that you can take it. So yeah. I'm curious, what's in the future?
So Rezactly it's the restaurant recommendation aspect of it. Netflix for restaurants is basically what I call it. That's the B2C component of the platform. So it's a fun tool. People use it. It's great. There's also the B2B aspect of the platform, which is basically the platform's interaction with restaurants. Currently, I think the number, like margins are incredibly thin at restaurants. I think the percentage closure rate or something is like 60% over 3 years, restaurants shut down. It's like, that is an insane number. Who is going into these industry when they have numbers like that? And I read an article recently on the New York Times. There's also like a mass exodus as far as people working in the industry, not even just talking about the restaurants closing. It's about people working in the industry. They quit very quickly. So I want to bring that number down. I'm trying to get feet into the restaurant. So the more feet I get into the restaurants, the less hopefully they'll close. The B2B aspect of it, when you have restaurants coming and updating their data, so updating their metadata, who they are, what they're about, ingredients, dishes. So that's like the basic aspect of it. But those reviews that I mentioned that you're putting in, they get to see it. They're private reviews. These aren't this is in Yelp. I'm not making those reviews public on restaurants' pages. They're private that the restaurants will get. So what happens right now is people generally don't put reviews when they visit a restaurant. There are two kinds of people who put reviews. People who really love the restaurant and people who really hated it. You don't have people in the middle just giving feedback to the restaurants. Now there is a motivation to do that, because basically the more reviews you give, the better your recommendations. And the restaurants also get more reviews. So they're able to also better their menus. Further to that, Rezactly offers analytics. So all of this data collecting, like these are all in the development. So I'm collecting information like who has visited your page, how long they stayed at your page, how often they visit your page, who I have the zip codes of people in. I have the zip codes of people where your restaurant is located. So I have people's dietary restrictions. So let's say, for example, you're a steakhouse and you find that everybody in your zip code is a vegan. You probably want to adjust your menu to offer some things.
Exactly.
Or you just say, we're no longer a steakhouse. We're this amazing restaurant. We offer something for vegans. So you have access to that kind of data and to that kind of information. You will now be able to make data-driven decisions about your dining menu. And hopefully these things, not only driving in feet, but also making the right decisions for what you put on your menu. Hopefully that keeps you open for longer. So that's the restaurant persona. We have the eater persona. We have the restaurant persona. We also have under development the chef persona, because not every chef works in a restaurant. You have these chefs who are aspiring to work in restaurants. You have chefs who are perfectly fine doing pop-ups. You have chefs who want their own restaurants. So providing structure around this whole ecosystem of being a chef and the different options, that's something IKEA want to do. I definitely want to build the platform for that persona. And my hope is with that particular persona, bring on an investor persona. So basically, they're able to, you basically use exactly the chef persona as a LinkedIn for the chefs. Because to the best of my knowledge, you don't really have chefs on LinkedIn, people coming, looking at their LinkedIn profile to say, okay, I'm going to invest in you. To the best of my knowledge, that doesn't happen. If it does, okay, great. I need to do some more market research. If it doesn't, this is something that I want to build with that. Ultimately, I feel personalization of the dining experience is the future. This is already happening, right? You go into a restaurant, the waitress says, what do you want? I don't eat this. I don't eat that. Can you make it this way? I want this temperature on the meat. It's already happening on a manual level. Fast forward 5 years, I think personalization will be the future. And I really want Rezactly to not only be a part of that story of personalization, but to drive that story and that implementation of personalization in the dining experience. The fun thing is I always wanted my own restaurant. So I still want my own restaurant. And I'm kind of hoping that what would happen is a person makes a reservation ahead of time. Chef has your profile, all of your dining experiences, all of your dining preferences. You come to the restaurant, check in, you're going to have a completely custom dining experience because we have everything that you like, all of that information. So we're able to make a completely custom dining experience for you. So,
wow. Well, that really sounds like the future of dining. You're absolutely right. And as someone who's done a foodie podcast for years, especially during the pandemic, I really love the idea of using this data as a way to saving restaurants. You know, we lost a lot of great culinary history in those individual markets, particularly in historically marginalized communities, especially those are hard hit. So it's really exciting to see that you're taking this tech, not only, like you said, help the B2C so that the average person using this will be able to find a really great like food truck or, you know, restaurant to visit, but they can also use it, the restaurant themselves, in order to adapt and really, you know, save the heart of what they do every day working in the industry.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's ultimately my personal goal. I am obsessed with restaurants. They are just my happy place. I love just going. I mean, there's the food and the drink, but the people who work there just make me happy. They make me smile. So they deserve.
What type of restaurant would you own, since you mentioned that was something of a dream of yours?
What kind of restaurant would I own? I'm not sure, really. I don't want to call it fusion because I don't like fusion restaurants. So I think something aligning to French cuisine or French preparation. So not necessarily any particular cuisine, but taking on the preparation styles of French cuisine, aka butter and lots of it.
Exactly. Well, I do have to say, with that in mind, if you ever do make your way to Chicago, there is one place that I can recommend. It's called Tony's Patisserie. It's in Chicago area. It's by the Loop. And I have to say, they have the world's best croque monsieur sandwiches. Mm-hmm. Like, seriously, lots of butter. Just, it's perfection. Like, every time I go there now, I'm pretty sure if this exists in Rezactly, it'll just be 100 for me. Like, I want, and they just know what I want. They're just like, oh, don't even ask her. She wants the croque monsieur. The croque monsieur and the aubergine. So, yes. I'm obsessed with French food. So, yeah. I could probably give you some recommendations to put into whatever you're ready. And you're right. It's the butter. Of course.
It is. It's just
the butter. Really, a child had it right.
I need to point out that for exactly the fans right now with the restaurants, they can sign up on their own. So I'm manually loading restaurants. So those ones that I mentioned, the cities, I'm manually loading those. But restaurants can, in fact, sign up. I am working on the dashboard right now for them to do all of this great information as far as coming onto the platform, ingredients, so on and so forth. I'm working on that, but they're able to sign up right now. And as soon as everything is ready, I'll just send an email out. Hey, dashboard is ready. You can come right in and maintain all your information.
That is exciting. So if our listeners want to check it out right now, they can go to rezakli.com. Is that correct?
Yes, they can go to rezakli.com. And if they don't want to go through a browser and type rezakli.com all the time, once they go to that, they can add it to their home screen if you're on an iPhone or an Android. So they can do that. Very, very shortly, I will be in the app stores waiting for a little one or two things. You know, when you're just waiting for someone like, hurry up. I'm at that moment. I'm at that point. So once I get that, I'll be able to complete a couple things and then submit to the app stores.
Awesome. Well, I want to be respectful of your time. So first of all, I just want to say, oh my gosh, thank you for taking time out to chat with me today. I feel like you and I would be kindred spirits if we hung out. Oh my gosh. You know what? We end every episode of the Gourmet Goober podcast, speaking of restaurants and wanting to uplift the industry, we usually close out with something we call the best thing we ate this week. And the idea is, again, we want to show love to, if it's like a, you know, a dive restaurant, a hole in the wall, a food truck, a fine dining space, even if it comes from your kitchen, something that you can share with our audiences. So if they want to try it for themselves, they definitely can. Now, obviously, this segment, now as I'm thinking about it, including this, is a little strange because your whole setup is basically an advanced version of this. Oh my gosh. And sorry, I just saw your cat wipe by. He ran the other way.
He was just scratching at me, and it took a minute for me to, like, oh crap.
No.
Smile.
Oh my gosh. Well, he's horrible. Glad to see that you're okay. Mine
really is there.
In fact, so hopefully you didn't hear that. But yeah, we would just love, given your incredible background and the platform that you're building, if you had something that you could recommend for our listeners to check out. One thing I also want to include is, we normally, if it's like an actual physical place and not your own, you know, recipe, because we've had, you know, people I've interviewed in the past share a recipe, but we usually try to share it in the show notes. So everyone who's listening, there'll be a link to it if they want to check it out for themselves.
Okay. So it's not a recipe. It's a restaurant. Lately, I've just been on burger mania. I don't know what's going on. I just wake up, I want a burger. I go to bed, I want a burger. I've just been on a burger hunt. And I had the burger at Nougatine. That's Jean-Georges restaurant.
Okay.
Earlier this, I was at the bar. I was like, okay, cut it in half, bit it. I was like, my God. You know, when you bite into a burger first, all of the juice gets on your face. You're supposed to put the burger down and then wipe your face and then pick up. Nope. I left it all there.
Wow. Okay. That sounds like a good burger. That's when you know you've been into a good one.
Getting all over my hands. The guy next to me was like, I have to ask, how is that? I'm like, you see, I didn't put this down, right? All over my face. That was a good burger. That was a solid burger.
Okay. So for those of us who want to check that out, just know I will put that link to the show notes so you too can experience that. Because just a look on her face, again, just to let everyone know how the sausage is made, whenever we do interviews, we usually set up a camera so we can see each other, but our listeners, of course, will just get the audio of this. And the reason why I'm saying this is as she's describing biting into the burger, there's just like this light that just emanated from her face, just the memory of biting into it. Like you could tell that this moment was like a moment of like unmitigated joy.
You have no idea. I just wanted to cry. This is decadent. It's a good burger. I can't wait back.
Okay, I'm going to have to put that on my bucket list of burgers to try. If you're ever in the Chicago area, there's a place called Kuma's Corners. I have a feeling that this is going to be a life-changing moment for you. You have to try their burgers. That's all they do. Like when I used to food blog, I told my husband, I'm no longer reviewing burgers because this is it. I literally told him that I just wanted to write in my review, this is the shit at the end. So I have a feeling that you will appreciate this as a suggestion. And now I have to go to New York and just try that burger. Because I'm telling you guys, the look on her face, it was just... I always loved this show because you can always tell when someone's really had something good, like a soul shaking good, and it just looks like this burger meat that for you. What's that?
Yes. Yes, it was. Oh, my. It was, my face was not that bad. Talking about it, I didn't realize I could taste it again. I'm not even kidding. I can taste that burger right now.
Okay, I have to admit, this will probably be the best recommendation we've had in the history of the show.
Thank you.
It's 5 years. I've never had someone say it's so good they can taste it again as they're talking about it. That's a burger.
It's a burger. It is an insanely good burger.
Oh my gosh. So on that note, Desiree, thank you so much for being on our show today. It was an absolute joy talking to you.
Thank you for having me. It was such fun having this conversation. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, I'm Carrie.
And I'm Emily.
And we're the hosts of A Dark Cup of History, a spin-off series to our regular podcast, A Nice Cup of History, where we dive headfirst into the weird and paranormal aspects of the world we all live in.
If you want to know your woman in red from your woman in white, what precautions to take against demonic dolls, and just where to go to find Black Shuck on a moonlit night, why not give us a listen?
Together we talk about the dark, creepy, and downright terrifying parts of our history and folklore, as well as what you should do if you ever encounter any of them.
Interested? Come and find us in Buzzsprout, Apple iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Pandora, iHeartRadio, and pretty much anywhere else you get your podcasts.
So turn on the lights, grab a blanket and some rock salt,
and let's get dark.
I wanted to take this opportunity to say thank you for listening to this special episode of the Gourmet Cooper podcast. Just as a reminder, next week, Big Daddy and I will be back with our regularly scheduled podcasts, and you'll be hearing three stories that once again cross the intersection of food and pop culture. In the meantime, thanks again to Fasayo Aluwadia for joining us on today's show. If you want to learn more about Rezakli, check out her food blog, which is called NYC Foodie Adventures, or if you want to get more information about that great burger she told us about, just check our show notes or visit us at thegourmetgoober.com. And till next time we meet, happy eating.